and genuinely believe that while it would blow up their world to have a single domain, it would be better for users.
Hello, and welcome to the One Team Gov Show, a podcast featuring conversations with awesome people doing interesting stuff in the public sector. Today, we're super excited to be recording at the One Team Gov Global event in London, where over 700 public sector reformers from around the world have come together to share, teach, and inspire practical action on an international scale. My name is Kylie.
And I'm Kamala. And today we're talking with Tom Loosemore, co-founder of the Government Digital Service and partner at Public Digital. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
When you first founded GDS, did you ever think that you would see a conference like One Team Gov Global?
No. There were many things when we founded GDS that at the time I could never imagine would be possible. And I've been blinking walking around today and sort of pinching myself because it's a global movement now. And not only is it a global movement, but it has moved beyond the domain of being anything related to technology, which thrills me because digital ways of working are about ways of working. And to have so many colleagues from around the world from policy and having those conversations together and trying to bridge that false divide, I think it's fantastic. Walking this morning, I literally, the hairs on my neck standing up is amazing.
That's great to hear. Just to dive into your origin story here, how did you get started working in digital and service design?
I was lucky, very, very lucky. I was probably one of the very first generations to go to university where we were just given the internet to sort of mess around with. I mean, I was an engineer, so you just got given the internet. This is before the web. And then while I was at university, the web happened, very early 90s. I'll be honest, I knew the first time I saw it, it would change the world. That sounds a bit arrogant, but I saw it and thought, oh my God, this is unbelievable. From that moment, I'm afraid the career as a civil engineer was never really going to cut it. I started out as a journalist working for Wired magazine in the mid-90s in the UK. And so I sort of got to know the then very nascent digital scene in the UK and the West Coast of the US pretty well. But that's what I mean about being lucky. I built relationships then that could only have happened because I was part of a small community. And then I worked at places like the BBC in the late 90s, putting BBC News, BBC Sport online. Worked abroad a bit in Amsterdam. But then the whole time I had lots of friends who were interested in all things public. And we spent a bit of time, a group of us, in our own spare time building services to try and improve accountability and democracy, particularly Parliament. Built websites like theyworkforyou.com and faxyourmp.com in the late 90s when you couldn't email MPs, but you could fax them. And so that really whetted our appetite, our group of us really, to sort of take a look at government. And from about the turn of the millennium onwards, wherever I was working at Channel 4 and Ofcom and places like that, be looking at the state of services in government, the way they were conceived as bits of IT. And I just raged, to be honest, I'd rant. It took me a while to realize that ranting is very satisfying, but it doesn't really change much. And so from about 2007 onwards, started to get much more politically savvy with a little P. A group of us, actually, not just me by any means, and actually started talking to ministers and shadow ministers of any political flavour and just saying, look, there is another way. There is another way. If you go and look how large internet organisations work, or even the BBC in parts work, it's a totally different mental model about how you deliver value and how you deliver services. It's not about technology, really. It's about designing things to meet the needs of users and doing so humbly and iteratively and empathetically. We were lucky in our timing that the NHS IT debacle, costing 10 billion plus, had just sort of hit. Politicians of all parties were very open to learning more about. It is a very radical change in ways of delivering public services. No point shying away from it. And so by the time the 2010 election came along, we sort of knew that whichever party got into power, or combination of parties, as it turned out, there would be a voice inside government that was open to more or less radical change. And so it transpired. I was lucky enough to be able to help Martha Lane Fox write her report, subtitled Revolution, Not Evolution, in the summer of 2010. And then I actually got to choose what we did first. I was ready to commit, you know, drop all my other work and just go for it. And decided to do gov.uk first out of all Martha's recommendations. And from that grew GDS, really. But I'll be honest, I never had any conception of a global movement like this. I've met a whole bunch of our clients today from governments around the world, and they're as amazed as I am just how many people are here and want to go on this journey.
So you just mentioned that you decided to do gov.uk first. Where did that idea come from?
It actually had its genesis on some conversations that Martha and I had, in that she was asking, why has the BBC managed to keep a single web address, as in bbc.co.uk, and not do bbcradio1.com and all the other variants? And I've been in the BBC, so I said, well, it's a hell of a battle, but it's one you absolutely have to win if you're genuinely user-centric. Because why should a user need to understand your internal structure before they can even find the right website, let alone the right bit of the right website? Martha was really keen that her report was genuinely radical. And so it was a very obvious thing to say, well, of course government should do this. I mean, why should you need to know the internal structure of government, let alone how often departments change names and merge and all the other things? But we also knew that putting that idea forward, if it was accepted at a sort of principle level, it would force a radical reimagining of how you delivered value and how you met user needs on the website. It gave you a sort of year zero. Almost by having the idea, you would be forced to redo much of the content, at least the content serving the needs of citizens who need it most. So yeah, Martha was like, right, it's gone, it's in. So I just wrote it in the report. And Francis Maude, who was a minister at the time, genuinely thinks about users first, actually. And we were very lucky that we had a minister that innately gets that. To be fair, there were ministers in opposition who also got that as well, and behind the scenes were very supportive. Can never be thanked, but it was a bit of a movement politically as well to simplify things for citizens. When it works well, the British democratic system is pretty good. That's the gov.uk story. I spend most of my time telling that story to other governments now. We're desperately trying to do the same thing without a Martha.
Everyone needs their own Martha. Maybe that should go on the next sticker. The single domain idea must have been quite controversial at the time in the civil service. How did you go about persuading people to get on board?
I mean, show not tell is the truth. It's why we did an alpha in 3 months to show what it could be like. And the alpha was really both to show how simple things really could be, but also to build the alpha version of gov.uk and launch it publicly using the ways of working that we'd been espousing in Martha's report about being user-centered, iterative, agile, open, etc. Has to be the right way to do it. You can't tell people why this radical idea is better. They have to see it and experience it and go, well, of course, it's simpler, clearer, and faster. But there's a sort of another truth to that as well, which is when we were writing Martha's report, I got to meet a lot of brilliant civil servants trying right at the front line of sort of digital in civil service to do the right thing. And this was an idea that they all latched onto. A cohort of people who were running departmental websites and genuinely believed that while it would blow up their world to have a single domain, it would be better for users. Without that cohort of people willing to sacrifice their own departmental websites for the greater good of citizens, it never would have happened. As ever with change, a third of people are up for it, a third of people are dead against it, and a third are swing vote. And really the job was to get the swing vote, third in the middle to see the prize for them. That's what showing the thing was about, really. The thing was in beta for more than a year. We did like 5 different versions of the beta. Constantly showing, constantly being open. But I won't lie, there were some very crunchy moments as well. People storming out of meetings. Some bad behaviour, I hate to say it. But to be honest, civil service is actually a far better behaved place than places like the BBC or The Guardian, where Mike and I both worked, where people just lie. People don't lie in the civil service, so they will tell you if you think you're wrong and you can have a direct conversation. It can get quite feisty. But if I'm really honest, it's quite hard to argue. Conway's Law, technology systems produced by government will always mimic the internal comm structure. It's very hard to defend Conway's Law. Even in 2010, 2011, it's very hard to be on the wrong side of that argument because you're on the wrong side of history. You know, I remember one department went from being a complete pain, to be honest. They were really nasty. And then they just came and saw me one day and went, we're sorry, we're all in. We've changed our minds. We're up for this. We want to go first, in fact. That's when I knew it was going to happen.
Many of our listeners will know that GDSN created the exemplar model. It was 25 exemplars. Both Kamala and I were lucky enough to work on one of those. Visit someone in prison. And many of the people here at the event today will also have worked on one of those. Which, if any, are you the most proud of?
Oh my gosh. Actually, I do have one.
Universal credit.
There was some fantastic work done, not least prison visits, but also Last Power of Attorney, stuff in DVLA was astonishing what they did there. I mean, miracles happened all over the country. I don't think anyone had the hospital pass that was trying to introduce digital ways of working into 13-14. And Lara Sampson, Deborah, and that team in DWP, oh my word. I mean, A, it's an incredible achievement to have launched a thing where, they just had an NAO report, very critical of aspects of the policy, and you can argue rightly so. They're not talking about the service design anymore. They're not talking about the technology being a failure. And that's because Lara and her team in DWP have got one of the world's highest performing at scale digital setups. They don't talk about it. They can't really mention universal credit in public and everyone just dumps on you, but
If you could get a chance to go to Caxton Heath and have a look at how they work and the consequence of that service on people's lives, the most vulnerable people in society, £100 billion a year plus of money going out, literally lives at risk. I'd humbled by that team, really humbled. In the context of a department that had been really burnt by trying to work agile and bluntly failing the first time, for good reasons and bad. So yeah, I'm very proud to know those people, fine civil servants.
Lara is absolutely one of my heroes as well, totally. So I'm glad to hear you mention her. You talked about the immense amount of pressure that the Universal Credit team are under, and we spoke about this actually in Kit's interview. What role did GDS help to play in being a bit of an umbrella for some of that?
A lot. Yeah, in the open and behind the scenes, a huge amount. And Mike Bracken in particular, you know, many people might not realize it, but wow, that man did so much to create space for teams and departments. Try and create the conditions by which teams could do what they by then knew was right. I wish we'd had far more people in GDS at the center to be able to put really experienced people in every single team in all positions. That's a bit of a regret, but you can't scale that quickly and you scale stupidly anyway. But what I did think worked really well, and this was utterly unintended, was the service manual and the service standard. Andrew Greenway and Richard Pope, who led the creation of the first version of that, getting something okay out really quickly. And the first version of the service manual was just about okay. And the service standard was just about okay. They were alphas. They were in shadow mode. But they gave teams the chance to say to people in their own department who were naysayers, look, gov.uk website saying we have to work this way. And there's a lesson really in that putting a manual out there saying there is another way and it's legitimized by being approved by the government as a way of working and well presented. That's something I talk a lot to clients about that really worked well and gave people a bit of an umbrella. We'll get into trouble if we don't work this way. Well, that's a very different dynamic from.
We certainly banked on that collateral many a time. If you can think of parts of the service manual, which ones were a bit more challenging to get through? So in my personal experience, test with the minister was always the hardest.
Test with the minister actually predated the strategy work that we did from which the service standard came. We got a call in the autumn of 2012 from Number 10 saying, we really love the work you've done with gov.uk. You've given us a sort of political prize. Would you like a line in the budget, which is tomorrow? You've got a line, one line, and we'll get it in the budget. So me, Mike and Etienne had to sit down and think, what do we put Etienne Pollard? Let's make the minister use it. And so it actually is in the budget, I think 2012, in the statement that ministers will use services before they go live. That it didn't have to go through the whole sort of clearing process that the rest of the service standard did. Not sure it would have got through. Too late by then. It had been spoken in the floor of the House, so job done.
What do you think has changed since your time at GDS?
Just the sheer numbers of people working in the new way. You keep finding new people doing great work who I don't know and following them. And in bits of government, I didn't even know existed, even though I worked right at the sharp end for 5 or 6 years. I look at some of the work that Pete Hurley and Tilworth are doing on platforms on gov.uk pay and gov.uk notify. And I tell you, the rest of the world are just agape at the quality of that work. I don't think people realize quite how good that work is. So, you know, from my perspective, there's tons of great work going on. The senior leaders, the Claire Moriartys, you know, even the Ollie Robbins of this world, they've seen another way. And they may not fully understand it as much as you might like, but they know there's a different way of working that's exciting. So then that's only going to increase as more and more people who've worked this way and enjoy working this way and see the benefits are going to get more senior in the civil service in the UK. Globally, oh my word, it's amazing. And I think this is a testament to Ben Terrett and Russell Davis's and Emma Coleman's push to have everything open that GDS did. So many governments just copied it, sometimes to amazing effects. Some of our clients, actually, former clients from Ontario here, done some incredible service design, and we turned up to do some work with them, and they knew it all. They hadn't been able to convince everyone in their organization. We were able to help, didn't just get a free flight to Toronto. But they literally had read it, and they'd done it, or started doing it, and were making great progress. And you go to places like Peru, and they do a single domain in 12 weeks. I kid you not, from having no people. I mean, they had a presidential decree. They're like, it's Peru, so there's not, you know, the websites are really awful that they're throwing away. But it's just staggering what's going on. And I'm very, very proud that, you know, the UK is still seen as the place to come to as witness today to learn about this stuff. I think the role of GDS had to change. You know, I think we had to leave. Disruption has its place, and 5 years is enough. You want to have a new normal then and calm things down a bit, make it less feisty. And there's still great work going on all over the UK government. Exciting times.
Well, thank you for allowing both me and Kamala to take our work here to the bank. We've since moved on to other governments around the world.
Right.
Why for you was it time to leave?
The level of disruption we applied to the civil service was extraordinary. And a lot of this was like doubling down again. And
the kind of leadership and the kind of people you need really positively disrupt. It's not the kind of leadership you need to normalize a brand new way of working in the long term. We all knew that. We're change agents. We're on a mission, and we'd taken that mission as far as we could in the sort of summer of 2015. We wanted to make damn sure we didn't leave at the same time as the election, because what we were doing is not political. But it was the right time to go. And for us personally as well, you kind of become a bit of a stuck record. I certainly, speaking personally, wanted to learn some new stuff and make some new mistakes.
As we touched on earlier, you're not a full-on Mandarin. You haven't only worked in government. You did stints at the BBC, The Guardian and Wired. What are the main lessons you've taken from your time in the private sector?
That it's very similar to government when you get beyond a certain scale of organisation. The challenge is the Conway's Law is absolutely applies in every large commercial organisation. The truth is, certainly in the UK, the best work going on in government is way ahead. In terms of the way of working, obviously the outcomes are different. It's a large organisation problem and a structural alignment problem as much as it's specifically a government problem. In fact, government has a bit of a problem in thinking it's special and different. It's not very big, it's not very special, it's not very different when it comes to service design, other than the need for universality, which is a big other than. The number of times I have argued with people saying, oh, government's big, and you go, it's not big, it's about the size of a small bank and transactional volume.
Yeah, that's oddly a really relieving thing to hear, that there are similar problems everywhere, even outside of government. So then you went to work at the co-op. Is it true that one of the services you worked on was ordering funerals online?
No, I didn't order funerals online. It's actually much more interesting than that. It's one of the most interesting projects I've ever worked on. Second biggest business in the co-op is its funerals business. It's a £350 million a year business. So one in five funerals are done by the co-op in the UK. Funerals are incredible. It's barely a business. It's more like a sort of social service. That's why people work there. It's a mission. It's where you get fifth, sixth generation funeral directors, family firms. And yet their service design is literally from the 18th century. I mean, it's barely paper. And so the huge opportunity I was lucky enough to be able to help the co-op take was to say, wow, we can save a lot of time, a lot of hassle, and make life much easier for the bereaved, faster for the bereaved, simpler, clearer, and also for the funeral directors by just applying some internet-era service design and organizational design and product thinking to this whole business. I'm really lucky to work with an incredible leader, a guy called Robert McLaughlin, one of the most incredible leaders I'll ever work with, who totally bought the vision and was able to hire, luckily actually nicked an incredible product lead from the BBC. Sorry, BBC. And wow, it was just incredible. It was did the whole alpha beta live thing, but also did the whole operating model change in sync, which is something Universal Credit did as well, was invent a new operating model at the same time as inventing a new service design, at the same time as inventing new policies and new products. Doing those three things in sync. So your alpha is not just about the service design. It's about the operating model, inventing that, and about, you know, maybe not the high level policy, but the policy detail. I think funerals is the closest I've come to where you're able to reinvent everything based on the principles of iteration and great user research. Yeah, I absolutely loved it. And I was also lucky enough to know when my time was up. Yes, there's always things to learn. I think from the co-op, the focus around really making values live was deep in the DNA of the organization and doing the right thing. And the closer you got to the shop floor, literally and figuratively, the stronger those values became. That's something I think I could learn, is where the values lived, they're at the front line. If you want to understand the values of the organization, go and listen to the phone calls and watch the face-to-face. Look over the shoulder of the person replying to the email. The co-op were good at that. And I think government could learn from that. Don't do what the BBC did, which is focus on what you used to do and make what you used to do better. The only chance the BBC had of being there for my grandchildren was to reinvent itself radically around the problems that the internet created for society, not the problems that broadcast created for society. And it had that window in the 2000s and it's way gone now. So putting programs online, yeah, that's nice, but that's no way going to be enough to justify £3.5 billion a year of taxation, essentially. Whereas if they'd gone, okay, the internet's great for the private sector, how do we make it amazing for the public sector?
So moving into the now, yep. You are co-founder at Public Digital. Why did you decide to set that up?
The honest truth is, when we went to the co-op, we didn't all want to work full-time. There was too many interesting opportunities coming our way. So we sort of did a deal that said we had a little bit of space to do some extra work, as long as it was outside the UK. So we set up this thing without too much thought, to be honest, and did a little bit of work, actually in places like Ontario. And then as we were coming to the end of our sort of stint at the co-op, we sort of looked each other in the eye. We went to drink one night, looked each other in the eye and went, the requests we're getting from governments around the world and from other large organizations, it just looks like a moment in time. Let's go for it. And so we might went full-time last summer, Ben at Christmas, Andrew Greenway joined us, and Emma Gawain has joined us now, and a bunch of other people have joined us. There's just such demand for government and large organizations to work a different way. We're lucky enough to have made more than our fair share of mistakes. Often people are buying our mistakes and knowledge of those mistakes, and I'm cool with that. Certainly spend a lot of my time telling people, don't do that. It's just incredible. I mean, we went to 14 cities in 3 months on 5 continents over the past 3 months. To see that range of different work going on, a range of different teams, and the ambition and the pace, and the different political context people are working in, what's the same everywhere, what's different everywhere. I'll be really honest, one of the really nice things, one of the things we promised ourselves we'd never do again, is have to persuade an organisation it needed to change, which was part of the deal coming into government and working at the BBC, and Mike would say the same, I'm sure, about the Guardian. And the joy of working at Public Digital is we only get asked if the organisation wants to change. So that whole grind just isn't there. Can help people who really want to change. What's not to like? I did an hour's phone call this morning. I talked to a client in Australia, and I literally said at the end of the call, that didn't feel like work, which I shouldn't have said because they won't pay me. But
so 14 countries in a very short space of time. Tell us an interesting, exciting story from one of those.
Argentina, blimey, a country with challenges. Centre-right technocratic leader comes in. Used to be the mayor of Buenos Aires, President Macri, sets up a Ministry of Modernization, brand new ministry, to drive modernization of the public sector. They've done single domain, they've put a whole lot of services online, they've done identity authentication, they've just done loads of digital stuff. But the one I want to talk about, which just like made me blink, was they have put 900 of their 1,400 business to government services, all of which were paper. They put 900 online in under 2 years, and they'll do the rest in the next 18 months. These are services run by, you know, dozens, hundreds of different agencies across the federal government. And then they showed me it. They said, look, this is what it's like. And service design could be better. And the visual design, you know, it's just a bit true to bootstrap, but it's going to change Argentina business like you would not believe. But I just couldn't believe the ambition level to do that. And then you ask people, how do you do it? I say, well, we have a mandate, we have a ministry, we have strong powers from the center, we're on a mission. It's the GDS story, but with another level of support from the president who understands, really uses the web a lot. And I think we're going to see that more and more. We're going to see senior leaders who understand what good looks like, and they're going to demand that from their civil services. And I hate to say it, but most civil services are structured like paper silos, and they just can't do it. And it takes a new ministry with a new shape and a new culture to do that. And I think that'll be a theme going forward, is how the shape of government, which dates literally, you talked to Andrew Greenway about the history of Whitehall. It comes from having department silo exist because paper was the only way you could store things top to bottom. And you have tunnels under Whitehall for shuffling paper about. Well, the internet and digital technology changes that. But our shape of governments typically is still vertical silos. And if you look at the institutional shape of Amazon, it's radically different. Then they've got dozens and hundreds and thousands of services as well on top that change every day and compete with each other and iterate by the second, because they are built on an infrastructure and organizational construct that enables that. The most exciting places you work are governments that are realizing that. I think the gap between the best and worst governments in terms of service design will increase a lot over the next 10 years.
One of our guests earlier today was from Argentina, a guy called Pablo. He's a service designer. The speed at which him and his organization have picked up that pace was just incredible. 900 services in 2 years is something that personally I would love to see in Canada, never mind the rest of the world. We'll see if we get there. Our attendees today at One Team Gov Global are all very privileged to have received the book that you co-wrote in our goodie bags today. What made Andrew and you decide to write all of that down?
To be honest, we were having the same conversations with clients again and again and again. It felt like the right thing to do, to sort of tell the stories of the things that worked and didn't in our experience, not just in government, but also beyond that. We were very lucky in finding a publisher that was really up for that. And Diane Coyle, who runs the Perspectives imprint, runs the Institute for Public Policy in Cambridge, amazing woman. She gave us free rein to go for it, and it's doing really well. I'm glad. I think it's one of their bestsellers, so glad for them. And I'm proud of a book I didn't write with my name on the cover, put like that. I'm very proud of Andrew for writing it. It's got some stuff in there that you can only learn by having made that mistake, and that's where the value is. And there's some stuff that it does work as well. Hopefully people will recognize it's a book written with sort of humility at its heart, really. Every organization is different. There are some very similar challenges. This stuff is really hard, and it's cultural that's the hard yard, not the technology. It's the business model that's the challenge.
So you mentioned about how you see the same thing happening over and over and over again in various different governments internationally. Are there any trends that you see which drive you nuts or really frustrate you?
The bastardization of agile, as in the application of wagile, essentially, waterfall agile methodologies that seem safe or safer.
that are actually just about doing technology slightly better than used to be done, but doesn't really do any interesting user research, service design, empathy-driven thinking. And yet governments think they're doing digital, and they're not. They're just fiddling while Rome burns. Part of this is that some of the vendors have caught on to the language and are using the language to have an excuse to keep charging too much money for not quite the same old day. It's better than that, but it's just scratching the surface of what the governments could and should be doing if they really looked at what their policy intent was and think, now let's think about the service design and inform all of that by user research. That drives me nuts, and I see that too often. I think that's a consequence of the changes in the vendor market. Governments all over the world are trapped by large vendors who go in the procurement system to win the work, and they've found a new way to game it, some new language. Having said that, there's also some amazing small and medium-sized companies out there doing amazing work, most of which I've never heard of before. And hopefully those companies can help government. The US is interesting. Something bubbling in the US slowly, Trump notwithstanding. I could see some interesting work coming out of the US in the next 5 years. There's enough vendors. Some of the vendors in the US are really good, and they're full of great people who really have done it before. And it's really finding the right client who's ready in the US to do it.
Lena Trudeau, who was one of our previous podcast guests, is going to work with government in DC, and it sounds like one of those ones you described, kind of quite small, quite fresh, but being genuinely good stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think in some places you do often find that private sector influence is helpful rather than the consultancy burns that we've all experienced.
I think the notion that spending some time helping the public sector and the governments improve as a sense of mission, you've worked in the internet world, that's a movement that's only going to get bigger as time progresses. I got a friend from school who works for Google. I can look her in the eye and say, I have never and will never do work that's as satisfying as the work I've done in government. You know, it's just more satisfying to help people than to make shitloads of money.
You mentioned earlier that this work is really difficult because a lot of it isn't to do with changing technology, it's to do with changing culture. Why is it so hard to change culture in organizations, in your experience?
When organizations get to a certain size, you get hierarchies. Hierarchies tend to create their own weather. Unless the culture of the organization is incredibly strong at being centered around the user need, people who get good at climbing the hierarchy are good at climbing the hierarchy, not good at meeting the needs of customers or users. The moment you've done that, you have created an incentive system for leaders to behave in ways that mean they will always find it challenging to move on from thinking what's bluntly right for me personally in my career to thinking what's right for the citizen or the user. That's why I admire people like Neil Williams so much for doing exactly that. He essentially blew his career apart for doing the right thing for the user. And that dynamic is true in pretty much every large organization. The younger the institution, the less like deep-rooted it tends to be, which is partly why places like Argentina and Peru, their governments are just younger, both in terms of age, but also in terms of the maturity. And the same is true for commercial organizations. The younger the organization, the less that sort of greasy pole syndrome mitigates against being truly centered around the needs of citizens.
And as we've alluded to quite a few times, government digital services are quite well established now, well, especially in the UK, but are now gradually spreading around the world. What do you see as the next step forward for digital in government?
Losing the word, although not too soon, because we need to change public digital's name at some point. Joking apart, I think that is a sign of maturity. As long as the organisation has really embraced it, the culture, processes, business models and technologies of the internet era, that's what I mean by digital. I disagree with you about well-established. I still think most digital services and governments around the world are still getting to first base, actually, which is winning the argument around this way of working and winning the argument around the necessity to redesign services around the needs of citizens. I think there's a long way to go with that. I actually think there's a long way to go with that in the UK still. That'll be a work of generation. The role of teams who provide foundations for services to be built on top of, be they platform services like gov.uk Notify, or be they data registers, of canonical data, which not enough is spoken. The creation of those new institutions that see their role as supporting hundreds, dozens, thousands of services or supplying data, those new institutions need creating. And I think the more mature digital services will move over time to establishing those new institutions, maybe not themselves, but spinning them up. I'm secretly quite excited by people like Paul Downey in the UK, who is one of the sort of original technical architects at GDS. He's an incredible man. He's gone off to work around local government geodata, particularly around sort of geographic registers of who owns what land and addresses. That's interesting and exciting for me. And I think that's a sign of maturity that he's gone to do that. And you see that happening in Denmark and Estonia, places like that, where they've essentially got new institutions being set up with an internet era culture who are supporting services, not just delivering services. Supporting services from all over government and not really caring about who pays. An investment for the infrastructure for the nation. That's a trend I hope to see more of. But truth is, most digital services are still a long way to go. We're not even near the end of the beginning yet, globally.
Well, it's keeping us all in a job. Let's pause for a moment and reflect on the fact that we're here at One Team Gov Global. How has your conference been so far?
Well, it's been relentless in a wholly positive way.
I have talked to more people in barely a morning than I can think of any other time, barring a wedding. I remembered most of their names, which is always nice. Only misidentified one person. Apologies to the gentleman from Biz, who I thought worked for HMRC. Caught up with a whole bunch of people I'd not seen for ages, which is great, but also met some new people and some people I bumped into around the world who turned up. There's a woman called Chu from Taiwan who I met in Harvard a month ago. She bumped into me today. A woman from New Zealand and Canada. One of my clients from Nova Scotia is here. It's just been such a maelstrom of interesting different perspectives and a real sense of movement and mission. It's genuinely incredibly exciting. Like I said, I felt just stunned this morning coming in and the hairs on the back of my neck genuinely were prickling. Let there be more. I'd love to see these happening in other countries.
The talk of the conference is that the next One Team Gov Global will be in Toronto. And I love the idea of a One Team Gov wedding.
There probably will be a few after today, by the looks of things.
Favourite session so far?
Kit making me cry at the start, talking about optimism. She always makes me cry, but I still enjoy it. Just the relentless optimism of this movement is incredible. Radical optimism, two incredible words to have together. And that's what this feels like.
Radical optimism. I've also heard vulnerable to joy today.
Good one. That's a t-shirt in the making.
It is. Let's get a sticker.
Yeah, I hope someone's designing stickers as we go.
Public Digital has a department of crayons.
An employee of one?
Our chief executive, Ben Terrett. Yep. Because you need a department of crayons and you must never tease them. Otherwise, they'll make your stickers look rubbish.
Our chief of design, who Kamala and I worked with at Ministry of Justice, is now in Canada. Chris Govius is still known as chief of stickers. For a while, we changed his name on the CDS website. Chris, chief of stickers.
And he obviously absolutely loves it. So, Tom, you're on the One Team Gov podcast, so it's only right that we would have stalked you to find out a bit more about you. I saw from your blog that you own a boat. Where are some of the coolest places that you've sailed to?
When I say I own a boat, if you actually look at the photos, it's about 12 feet long with a sail. So the coolest places I've sailed to are some of the marshes in deepest Essex. My favourite one, 19 days out of 20, it's a firing range. And you can't sail there. But one day, once every 3 weeks, they lower the red flags and you can sail in these creeks where no one has been. And it's just a magical moment where the wind and the waves and your soul combine to find peace and calm. So that's about 60 miles from here. Where I can, I go and sail the muddy creeks of Essex in my little dinghy.
And have you ever had any capsizes or near misses?
I'm a total coward. I'm also incredibly cautious, actually. I once got hit by a thunderstorm, which brings with it some very, very strong and scary winds. And that was a little bit close. Didn't tell my wife about that one. I didn't capsize, but it was a bit hairy.
Oh, here's hoping she doesn't listen to this podcast. Yeah, otherwise, The cat's out the bag.
Actually.
We always wrap up our podcast shows asking you to recommend a couple of things for us. Recommend us a Twitter account we should follow.
It's a bit UK specific. One of my favourite Twitter accounts is called PPE in PPE. Mm-hmm. And it's pictures of mostly politicians wearing personal protective equipment. Basically fluorescent jackets on building sites with hard hats doing a tour. And the PPE at the start is Politics, Philosophy and Economics, which is a degree that only Oxford University offers. So it's basically a whole Twitter account of photos of people who've done one very small degree at a very small university, wearing a very, very niche set of clothing, looking around building sites, having press photographers take photos of them. The reason I like that one is because if ever there was an indicator of the lack of diversity in our democratic system, it's the fact that you can have a Twitter account about politicians, ministers, senior officials who have only done one degree at one university. None of those three initials, politics, philosophy, and economics, include anything about empathy, really, about technology, about design, and they run the place. Look at that. If you want to see who actually runs Britain, PPE in PPE, you recommend that?
We want to be as fluorescent with rage as their high-vis jackets, for sure. Any podcasts?
The podcast I really get the most out of at the moment is called Griefcast. It's a podcast by a British comedian interviewing other comedians from around the world about loss and grieving for someone. And it's both funny and incredibly moving. I lost my mum when I was young, and I've listened to them all, and they've helped me understand the process of grieving. And it's just a beautifully produced podcast. Even if you haven't experienced grief, go and have a listen. If you have, must listen to Griefcast.
And a book?
Obviously, I'm going to recommend Digital Transformation at Scale, Why the Strategy is Delivery, by Andrew Greenway and some other blokes who didn't really write a word.
That's a total cheat. You have to give us at least one other book.
I am going to recommend a book that, again, has absolutely nothing to do with the internet, but it's one of my favourite books, which is called The Riddle of the Sands
proto-Bond-esque novel from the turn of the last century involving sailing and mystery and Germans. It's just an incredible one and just captured me as a kid completely. And it's still one of my favourite. I read it every 3 or 4 years, actually, because it has absolutely nothing to do with the internet.
We're going to wrap up with a charity or social enterprise we should support.
Citizens Advice, who in the UK run thousands of volunteer-run mainly outlets to help people who literally don't know what to do. Their digital transformation, which they've been doing for the last 3 or 4 years, is incredibly impressive. I always support Citizens Advice. I've pointed quite a few organisations to go and have a look at them. Now, those organisations need to respond to the internet era as well and change the way they work. And if Citizens Advice can do it, they can too.
Citizens Advice, in all of our experience, plugs a lot of gaps that government can't fill at the moment, so they support that recommendation. Tom, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Pleasure.
It's been such good fun.
Yeah, thanks so much, Tom. That was an absolute blast.
Thank you for asking me such hard questions.
So Kamala, we've pulled out the big guns and finally got co-founder of GDS. What did you reckon?
Oh my God, I'm just so happy that we have finally managed to land ourselves one of the UK digital founding fathers. It was such a good interview and it was so good to hear how GDS got started, the small start that GDS had with gov.uk and how it developed into this model of the exemplars and then on into the way that government works today.
He had some absolutely brilliant stories, even from way before GDS. I loved what he was saying at the beginning about how he got started in tech. Being at university in the early 90s, got given the keys to the internet just to mess around with, which sounded really fun. And he talked a lot about how he felt really lucky to have fallen into that profession and be able to work in it, even though he was trained as a civil engineer. A combination of, I guess, circumstance and having met some people who were interested in the same sort of things and then pursuing it, which is a pretty good message for us.
Yeah, definitely. I love how that is a trend of people's foundation stories on this podcast, that actually a lot of how they end up in digital and in this world is just about luck. And a lot of people are humble enough to call that out, especially Tom, is a really good thing. So Kylie, were you upset that he didn't say that his favourite exemplar was Prison Visits Booking?
I was a tiny bit gutted, yeah. But to be fair, he did give some shout outs to the other favourite ones I would have picked. Lasting Power of Attorney, Universal Credit. They're pretty all-star teams, so I'm pretty cool with that. He also did an excellent amount of fangirling of Lara Sampson, who is one of those little known people in government, but is absolutely my hero.
I thought it was awesome that he did a shout out to the people who continue to work on Universal Credit, obviously a service that's had a rocky history and has been really, really difficult to deliver. That was really cool to hear him do that.
His reflections on change were really applicable in any context, and I like how he really called that out. A lot of people have this special snowflake idea. We see it at the service level, at the departmental level, and at the organizational level in government, where you have people who are absolutely convinced that the way that government operates or my service operates or my team operates is completely unique and we have to build something that's really custom. Whereas he was saying, actually, government is about the size of a small bank and it's not very special and it's not very different and it's not very big. And I liked that because it's the message that we feel through the work that we do. And also his mention of that theory of change where you have a third of people who are up for it, a third really against it. Your mission is to find the third who are the swing votes and convince them.
Yeah, that's really useful because often those people who are not up for it are the loudest people. And so it's always really good to bear in mind that there is that sort of soft middle that you can try and convince. Related to that, we asked him about the private sector and what the main differences were. He said it's really similar to working in the public sector and has exactly the same problems. There's something quite heartening to know that actually large-scale organizations are facing the same difficulties and therefore can have similar outcomes if you make the right changes. And that the work that's being done in the public sector in the UK especially is far ahead, in his opinion, of the private sectors.
He had some really cool stories as well from the beginnings of GDS. What you won't hear in the edit is that quite a few times he said to us, should I say this? Oh yeah, I'll just go for it anyway. That story about testing with the minister being the result of getting a call from number 10 and just being asked to put something in the budget. bury the thick of it, continuing our thick of it theme throughout the podcast. What did you reckon to his work at the co-op? That was really interesting.
Yeah, I love the story that he told about the funeral business and how that's more of a social service as opposed to actual business, and how by putting into place some digital practices, you can really transform the way in which people experience that. When I heard that they were all going to the co-op, I really did not expect service design around funeral businesses to come out of that. It just shows that in spite of how emotive or how personal the service is, it can always be improved by using these sorts of techniques.
The one bit that really stood out to me when he was talking about the co-op was when he said that organizational values live on the front line. We see that a lot in government, hallowed halls of Whitehall versus the people who are working in a hospital or as a prison officer or as a teacher in a school. The people who really feel the mission and the values of public service most keenly and are most passionate about them are the people who are right out there, far away from where most of us live in the policy and tech world. And just a reminder that if you want to feel inspired, go and talk to them.
It's our job to go and talk to them. I thought that was a really, really good point. What did you think of his glamorous sounding life now?
Well, if I could do that in a couple of years' time, that would make me extremely happy. I don't think I would say no to that. That's pretty cool. Getting called up to go to somewhere in South America or Australia, New Zealand, really fun. I would go for that.
Yeah, I would definitely take that crick neck any day to go on all those flights.
What he said about public digital when we were asking him what the kinds of conversations were that he's having in these other countries, the thing that really resonated for me was when he said, people are often buying our mistakes. The fact that we've gone through those tough years at GDS in setting it up and then fighting all of the battles throughout, that's what you can do once you've pushed through and made such massive organizational change. You then get to share that with other people.
Yeah, I thought that was really awesome because our perception of consultancy and people coming in and helping out senior leaders is the selling of ideas. So you think about the big consultancies, the big four, that's what they tend to do. But the idea of selling the mistakes that you've made and saying, hey, I don't know how to fix this, but just don't do this thing, I thought was a really cool idea. Another point that I really liked was how a lot of governments that he's visiting are so ambitious. He talked about Argentina and about how they're putting 900 services online and the president is really pushing that to happen and demanding that, and how that happens a lot, especially in younger governments. That was a really good reminder that we still have to be that ambitious, and just because we get to a certain point in terms of service design and service transformation and we get a lot of accolades, it doesn't mean that we should stop being as ambitious.
Yeah, definitely. The governments which have the biggest motivation to change are the ones that absolutely have to. And I think it's easy for us because, as you said, we're in the context of it all the time and it feels like the new normal that this is the way that we do things. But actually the need for pace and the need to change rapidly and to meet the needs of the evolving internet era haven't slowed down at all, so we shouldn't either.
I liked what he said about his Twitter account. His favorite funny one is PPE and PPE. That's people who have gone to this really specific course in Oxford and are in PPE hats because they're on a building site. Really, really funny and actually really, really sad, and just shows that throughout government and throughout the civil service, we really need to try and get a bit more diversity.
The final thing we spoke about, Tom going out in his boat.
I liked how he said, it's definitely not a boat, it's a dinghy. And I went and looked it up and it really is a dinghy. When we're both back in the UK, we can ask him for a trip on it. I'll probably capsize it. So live podcasting from the dinghy.
We'll get him in his captain's hat.
And that's it from the One Team Gov show. If you enjoyed this episode, you can download, listen and subscribe through all major platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, Pocket Casts, Blubbery, Spreaker, Acast, Radio Public, Player FM, Overcast and Podbean. We're also available on Amazon Alexa. See you next time.
See you next time.